From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The open range, where the buffalo roamed, until they were driven to near extinction during the 19th century. That environmental disaster opened the 30-year saga of a booming cattle business, with tens of thousands of cowboys moving millions of head across the prairie. Along with it came gunfights, prostitution, industrial innovation, and a legacy of conservation that gave birth to our national parks. This hour on Point, when cattle was king in the American West. You can join us on air or online. What do you want to know about this chapter of U.S. history? What's your perception of what cowboy life was like? Does it sound appealing or dreadful? And if you're involved in the cattle ranching business in some way, tell us what that life is like today. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining us now is Christopher Knowlton. He's the author of the new book, Cattle Kingdom, The Hidden History of the Cowboy West. You can read an excerpt of it at our website, onpointradio.org. He's with us from Santa Barbara, California, but Chris lives in Jackson, Wyoming. Chris Knowlton, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Sasha. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's really good to have you. And anyone who had a romanticized view of cowboys is certainly going to come out with a much different view after having read your book. You certainly pierce a myth to a certain degree. Maybe you can start us off by telling us what you think the mythology of cowboy culture is, or maybe what you thought it was before you began researching your book.
Well, I think most of us have an impression of a rather glamorous life based on the Westerns, the John Wayne Westerns that we've seen, and, you know, right up to the more recent Clint Eastwood ones. Some of us grew up watching, you know, programs like Rawhide on television as kids, and we have a rather romanticized view of what it was actually like.
We actually have a little piece of tape from Rawhide, so this seems like the perfect time to play it. This, of course, was a 1960s TV series, and it portrayed the challenges of cattle drives through the American West. We have a piece from the opening scene. This is an early episode in which the trail boss, Gil Favor, who's played by Eric Fleming, describes three things essential to every cattle drive.
Bringing a herd up through the plains of Texas on the Sedalia-Missouri Trail, you need three things. One of them, air. We have more than enough of. Another, grass, usually in good supply. But the third is another story. It's always with us. The need for water. Sometimes it's a real job to find it, and it's my job.
So Chris Knowlton, as they talked about, sometimes water was in short supply, but even that may be underestimating the kind of challenges cowboys faced. Give us a sense of what was hard out there on the open plain and the prairie.
Right. Well, of course, driving 2,000 to 4,000 head of cattle was a technical obstacle of the first dimension. You had to know exactly where to, ride your horse and what flank to be on, and exactly what to do if there was a stampede. Getting the herd across a river was a major obstacle. You had to avoid mills and. Of course, lightning could lead to stampedes. It was a major challenge, and a lot of these cowboys, these were Texas ranchers right after the Civil War. They'd never done this before. They were trying to get their cattle up to the railroad heads in Kansas in order to sell the beef into the northeastern market. There was a new appetite for steaks as the standard of living rose in New York and Boston and Philadelphia and places like that.
So the path basically was move all these herd of cattle from Texas up to the railroads more in the center of the country, then get them to places like Chicago where they'd head to the slaughterhouses.
That's exactly right. The railroads hadn't penetrated into Texas, so they had to take them 1,500 miles north before they could reach the railroad heads, get them on a railroad car, get them to the slaughterhouses in Chicago and St. Louis. Chicago, of course, became the epicenter of the meatpacking industry. But those cowboys, they were young, they had relatively little experience, and it was lonely, it was hard, it was didn't even have ponchos or tents in the early days.
It was truly sleeping under the elements.
Yeah, you had to learn how to break your Bronco. You had to you had to have quite a few skills, roping and later branding. It was the beginning of really an extraordinary period in American history. And one of the interesting things is that this story hasn't really been told in a narrative nonfiction form in over 40 years. So there was a lovely opportunity in Cattle Kingdom to tell this story and bring it back to the American public and to really give a visceral sense of what it was like on the trail and what it was like to walk down, say, the main street of Cheyenne, Wyoming in the 1880s and what you'd see in the stores and what things cost. And that really was my goal, that plus to tell some of the adventure stories and to give the perspective not just of the cowboy but of the rancher, because the ranching piece of it, the business part of it, is equally important to the American narrative.
And you really do that so well in terms of conveying this sensory, tactile sense of what it was like to be out there and to talk about the larger lessons learned from this era, which we'll get back to. The piece of tape we heard from Rawhide, again, that was a 1960s show. I want us also to listen to a piece of tape from a current show. This is from the Food Network, and it's called The Pioneer Woman. It really glamorizes life on the frontier. And this is Reed Drummond's family ranch near Pawhuska, Oklahoma. Let's listen to this exchange.
It's a busy time on the ranch, and the family's been working since dawn. So I'm making them the ultimate ranch dinner: chicken fried steak, mashed potatoes and gravy, and a marinated tomato salad.
This is pretty close to a perfect meal.
The next morning, the family's back in the saddle for another 5 a.m. cattle gathering. And I'm cooking up cowboy breakfast sandwiches and sunrise punch.
All right, I gotta head back to the house.
You still got some stuff to do.
Welcome to my frontier.
So, Christopher Nolden, how much is that anything close to reality for what meals were like for cowboys in the era you wrote about? Were they really getting marinated tomato salads and these wonderful filling meals?
Well, of course they weren't. The standard fare was something they called son of a bitch stew, which was really a mix of leftovers and parts of the cow that you'd really rather not talk about. Things like wild onions that you found along the route were really considered a delicacy. So they got very tired of the food. They were very eager to get to a cattle town at the end of a cattle trail and have better food and some fun and get clean and start to enjoy themselves and spend their hard-earned money.
Go into some more detail, if you would, about just how hard it was out there, because you just write the most vivid scenes in the book about riding all day in blinding snowstorms and cattle falling through ice on frozen rivers, the wolves starting to move in. I mean, it was both dangerous but also dull. And as you said, most of these cowboys would not do it twice. So what drew them to it, and then what drove them out of it?
Well, it was really economic necessity that drove them. There was the currency in the Confederacy after the Civil War was valueless, and they really had few other options. For a lot of these boys, they were farmers as well, and they wanted to get on a horse and get out into the open prairies, and there was an element of it that really was quite exciting. The freedom sounded just marvelous, but a lot of them didn't understand how narrow their career prospects really were getting into the cowboy business. It was such hard work. Most of them were broken down after 7 years, and very few of them stayed in the business. But they had few alternatives. I mean, if you wanted to perhaps get into the livery business, the automobile would soon put that out of business. If you wanted to become a butcher, the meat packers kind of did away with a lot of the butchers. And if you wanted to be a saloon owner, well, prohibition was on its way. So you had few alternatives, and there was little in the way of an attractive retirement package at the end.
Right. You kind of describe them as indentured servants. These were not the guys who were coming out on top financially or in any other way at the end.
Right. The pay was poor. It was, $25 a week for a awfully arduous existence. There was no medical care to speak of. The chance of getting disease was really the great threat. I talk in the book how very, you know, the cattle towns themselves, which are depicted in the movies as so violent, did not really have an inordinate amount of gunfighting. The real danger was, you know, disease for these guys. There just were few doctors out there, and there was no penicillin. There was no cure for tuberculosis or smallpox or any other of the diseases that we today just, the cures we take for granted.
Right. You have this great line where you say that doctors were scarcer than Latin scholars on the range. And again, in a pre-penicillin era, you get cut by some barbed wire or you contract a venereal disease in a brothel, and that can be fatal.
Yeah. No, precisely. And then venereal disease as well, because let's face it, they were going to, when they get to a cattle town, they were going to visit a brothel.
Right. And when we come back from the break, I want to hear more about, you talk about the loneliness factor. I mean, these guys were by themselves. Even if they wanted to get married, they probably didn't have the money. And if women had any sense of what life was like out there, they probably weren't going to marry these guys. So it was a lonely existence in addition to a very difficult existence.
That's exactly right.
We're talking about the American West and the boom-bust cycle of 19th century cattle ranching. This is Frankie Lane singing the theme from the 1960s TV series Rawhide. This is On Point.
Don't try to understand them. Just rope them, throw and brand them. Soon we'll be living high and wide. My heart's calculating. My true love will be waiting. Be waiting at the end of my ride. Move 'em on, hit 'em up, move 'em on, hit 'em up, rawhide. Cut 'em out, ride 'em in, let 'em out, cut 'em out, ride 'em in, rawhide.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the open-range cattle era at the end of the 19th century. You can join the conversation. Did you grow up with the romance of the American West? Do you now realize it was over-romanticized? Were you a fan of the films and TV shows that glorified cattle drives? Are you surprised to hear our guest Chris Knowlton talk about how arduous those drives actually were? And Chris Knowlton, our guest, is the author of a new book, Cattle Kingdom, The Hidden History of the Cowboy West. Chris, in terms of who these cowboys were exactly, let's listen to a piece of tape from another 1960s TV show. This is the NBC Western Bonanza. In this one, Hoss Cartwright, played by Dan Blocker, is worried about some of the cowboys that his father Ben, who's played by Lorne Greene, hired for an upcoming cattle drive.
Brazos rounded up a crew. He knows the country we'll be traveling.
Where'd you round him up? Out of the nearest jail?
Some of them, maybe. Driving cattle up the trail ain't exactly my idea of a church social. I want the hardest boys I can find.
Well, it looks like you found them, mister.
I want the hardest boys I can find. So, Chris Knowlton, tell us, who were these guys? And I am assuming they were all guys, the cowboys of this era.
They were all guys. Well, it turns out that they were fairly diverse. I mean, America was really a melting pot at this point, and so you had a lot of Texans, of course, but very quickly you had the various immigrants that were important in the day. You had Germans, you had Italians, you had Scandinavians. In fact, one historian looked at the kind of a census of one of the cattle towns, and you had representatives of 27 states and 14 different countries in that cattle town at one point in time. It gives you a flavor of just what a true melting pot it was. And a lot of people have said that the importance of this era, at least one important factor, was that it helped to bridge the differences between the North and the South after the Civil War. And part of that was because you had these two once warring groups now mixing in commerce. There were former slaves, not a lot of them, but there were some out there. There were Native Americans who had great horseback riding skills who became cowboys. You know, you had 50,000 to 70,000 of them for this sort of 30-year period. A lot of them working on ranches that popped up all over the open plains and in Montana, Wyoming, Colorado. And they had this romantic lifestyle, but didn't always end up so well for them.
When you talk about how difficult it was to trail cattle, you write at one point that it was probably the least fun job of the entire industry. Does that actually include slaughterhouse work? Would you say trailing cattle was worse work than slaughtering?
Well, you've got me there. I'd have to say that slaughtering cattle is pretty unattractive. And back then, it was even worse than it is today, which is to say there were very few safeguards for the workers, let alone regulations that ensured food safety. Slaughterhouse work was absolutely filthy and disgusting and dangerous. I think the contrast I was trying to make was between the life of some of these cattle ranchers. You know, if the life of a cowboy was adventure, the life of a cattle rancher was to be king. And that's a quote from famous American historian Walter Prescott Webb. And he really put his finger on it. The cattle ranchers, who often were from wealthy families in the East, as well as, interestingly enough, and people don't know about this, but a lot of aristocratic families from the UK, and then they're included in that some German barons and some French dukes. And so
right. I think you say that even Rockefellers and Vanderbilts and Marshall Field, big, big money names investing in this area.
Yes, yeah, so they were. This was really the dot-com bubble of its day. And it attracted money from all around the world. The British disproportionately so, because they really were, you know, astride the world at that point. Their empire was predominant, and they had the capital. So they poured a lot of the early money into these cattle ranches. But these cattle ranchers, they had a pretty good time. And I talk about what life was like for them in Cheyenne in the 1880s. And believe it or not, they were dressing up in black tie and drinking fine wines and smoking Cuban cigars and playing polo and having a pretty good time.
Yeah, Cheyenne sounded like sort of the Deer Valley or Vale of today back then.
Yes, that's right. That's right. A lot of the barons built their second homes there, and they had fancy carriages and that were like the limousines of today, and they were really enjoying themselves.
Chris, we have several callers who want to weigh in. Let's go to Travis calling from Detroit, Michigan. Travis, welcome to On Point, and tell us what you think about this cowboy culture conversation.
Oh. Hi. Yeah, I was kind of curious. Like, so I see there's a big disparity. I was wondering, like, what the pay dynamics were between, like, so the cowboy doesn't earn that much, and the people that own the cows, would you relate it in modern day to, like, working at Walmart or, like, an undocumented field worker or McDonald's, or how would you relate it to today?
Yeah, the pay was virtually identical to what a young factory worker would make as in an entry level job. So the work of a cowboy is never paid well. It still doesn't. I think they might earn today $25,000-$30,000. We can talk about that later, but it was pretty poor pay. At the end of a trail drive that lasted 3 months, you might have $125,000 paid to you in gold coins, and you were walking into a cattle town that was really designed to separate you from that money as fast as they could, whether it was through gambling tables or pool tables or brothels.
We have another caller, this one from Flag Pond, Tennessee. This is Grover. Grover, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Just a little family history. My grandfather was William Robinson, was born in 1856, and I have a picture of him sitting on his horse with buffalo hide chaps with the hairy side out, a large hat on, a vest, and an 1873 Colt Peacemaker stuck down his belt. Now, at the time, it was 3 to 4 months' wages to purchase 1873 Colt Peacemaker. He came back to West Tennessee about 1900, bought 100 acres of land, and he had changed his name to Robertson. I asked my only one picture of him, that one of him sitting on his horse, and I used to ask my grandmother to tell me more about my grandfather, about him being out west, and she said he would never talk about it. So it's always been curious to me how he came back with enough money to buy 100 acres of land and having changed his name.
Did your grandmother have a theory on why he didn't want to talk about it?
No, that's all she would say. She just said that he didn't want to talk. He never talked about his time out west.
Chris, this would be speculating, but there were were there things that could happen out there that would make a cowboy think, I'm simply going to leave that life behind in every way, including changing my name and not discussing what I saw or did?
Yeah. Well, there are, and I talk about a couple of these characters who had some dubious backgrounds and ended up there and got into some trouble. But you're talking about a period in American history where there, you know, particularly out west, there were few courtrooms, few judges. The judges who there were had to sort of travel around, and they had an enormous caseload. So, you know, the kind of prosecution of crimes that went on was somewhat haphazard. And of course, we know about a lot of the vigilante stuff, and there was plenty of that. You know, if you had an experience with some of that, you might not be too proud of it. But there were people that made some money in the business and were able to retire rich, or enough to have a grub stake to get started. But that was really the exception to the rule, because one of the things that happened at the end of the era was there was a lot of the ranchers had misjudged the environment and didn't understand how harsh the winters could be. There was a terrible die-up, it was called, in 1886, 1887, that changed the industry forever. And 1 million of the cattle on the open range died in this horribly harsh winter. And the business was never the same after that.
This is the big die-off you write about.
They say die-up as in round-up, because it was a little like a it was an enormous, terrible consequence to the industry, and it never really recovered. Ranches had to be smaller after that. You had to grow your own hay. It really changed the economics and the dynamics of the business.
We have another piece of sound from a movie. This is Open Range. It was from 2003, and it tells the story of cattlemen driving a herd across the country. They stop in a Montana town that's controlled by an Irish land baron, played by Michael Gambon. And this land baron hates open range cattlemen. He wants to fence everything. This is a scene with a cattle rancher played by Robert Duvall, and it illustrates the tension between landowners and cowboys in the end days of the cattle boom.
I got the biggest spread around these parts. Big 93 or 4 put together. Built it up with my own two hands, piece by piece, along with this town. And there ain't no free-grazed cattle going to take the feed off my cattle on this range.
Free-graze is legal.
Times change, Mr. Spearman. Most folks change with them. A few holdouts never do.
Times change. So to weigh in on changing times, we actually have a cattle rancher from Montana who is able to join us this hour. This is Kent Hanawalt. He is from Clyde Park, Montana, and he is the author of Ain't That Romantic, Adventures of a Montana Cowboy. I should note that romantic has two exclamation points and a question mark after it. So there's a big question about just how romantic it is. Kent Hanawalt, thanks very much for being with us this hour.
Hi, Sasha.
Can you tell us a little bit about the ranch you're on, its family history, and the role you play there?
Well, the ranch I'm on was homesteaded by my wife's grandfather in 1896. And I've been managing the ranch myself for the last 15 years.
Does that involve working with livestock as well as agriculture?
Well, working with livestock is agriculture. Yes, the basis of this ranch is a herd of cattle. And the extent of the agriculture is simply the extent of the farming is simply cultivating the hay that we feed the cattle in the winter to prevent a great die-off.
So you grow what you feed them.
Exactly.
And as you have listened to Chris Knowlton talk about the difficulty of cowboy life, do you feel like you can relate to that at all, given what your work is like today?
Oh, absolutely. One of the most boring jobs of a cowboy career is trailing cattle.
What makes it boring?
You're simply following along behind. a bunch of cows. The joy in cowboying is doing the sorting and the roping and working with cattle from atop a good horse.
Oh, really? Because there's some skill involved in that? Excitement?
Yes, there's skill involved in that. And trailing cattle is something that has caught the romance of the entire world. And trailing cattle now, for the most part, is done with an ATV.
Oh, really? So it's not a top horseback anymore?
Takes no skill on the part of the horse, no skill on the part of the rider.
You mentioned to one of our producers before the show that now that open range has ended, obviously people fence off their property. And that means that if you own a large ranch, a lot of your time is spent repairing fence. Is that a lot of what you find yourself doing?
That's what we spend most of June doing.
Oh, is that right?
Kent, I saw on your website that some good stuff about the economics of the business, and it's still really tough to make a profit. You talk about the cost of raising a single steer and what you might sell it for, and it looks like most people still don't do terribly well. A lot of ranchers.
The national statistics are that 97% of ranches don't make an honest profit. If a person had $1 million to invest in something, they would invest it in something like a commercial property that would pay 15% interest and cover all the expenses. A ranch will not pay you a profit, will not pay all your expenses. Where you get your profit is in the sale of the ranch, in the appreciation of the ranch land.
So you're really just in it for the land and the real estate potential.
Well, you're really in it for the lifestyle.
Do you think many ranchers go into this naive, or are they walking in aware of how difficult the economics are?
I think most of the people who buy ranches now are pretty naive.
Does that include some of the celebrity names that have ranches? I think David Letterman, Ted Turner, Tom Brokaw, these are sort of modern cattlemen. Is this a luxury, or is this a business for them?
Oh, absolutely a luxury. They don't intend to make a profit.
It's a trophy asset.
Simply with the goal simply of having a place to go, a peaceful place, something to do with their downtime?
Yes, that's part of it. Another part of it is after 2001, when the stock market broke, people realized that having stocks and bonds and money in the bank may not be a long-term asset in the way that land is.
That's interesting. But I felt like it was something tangible.
Sasha, if I could just interject, there are still something like 600,000 mostly small cattle operations across the country, and many of them are multi-generational. They've had to do the business in different ways, and it's a lot smaller. Most of them, don't have more than, I think on average, like 50 head of cattle. So they're pretty small, but they're still out there.
Kent Hannawalt, thank you so much for joining us. Kent was with us from Clyde Park, Montana. He is a Montana cattle rancher and author of Ain't This Romantic, Adventures of a Montana Cowboy. We're discussing the cattle boom during the last few decades of the 19th century. And this is Lorne Greene, who played Ben Cartwright on Bonanza, singing the long-running Western TV series theme song. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
We got a hold of a pot full of gold Bonanza, with a house full of friends with the rainbow ends. How rich can a fella be? On this land we put our brand, our pride is the name. Fortune smiled the day we filed the Ponderosa claim. Here in the West we're living in the best bonanza, the friendliest, whitenest, lovinest band that ever set foot in a promised land. And we're happier than them all. That's why we call it Bonanza.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the rise and fall of the late 19th century's booming cattle industry. Join the conversation. Let us know if you see parallels to today's boom-bust economies, and are there lessons to be learned? I've been talking with author Chris Knowlton about his new book, Cattle Kingdom, The Hidden History of the Cowboy West. And Chris, we have several callers who'd like to weigh in, some of whom have had experiences with cattle ranching or the cowboy life in some way. Let's go to Anne calling from Ipswich, Massachusetts. Anne, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. About 40 years ago, I had the pleasure of getting to know an elderly gentleman by working on his horse farm in Connecticut. He was not your typical cowboy by any means. He was Yale-educated and came from a rather well-to-do family who apparently was related to the family that owned the Bell Ranch, because from the time he was in high school, he spent summers out working on the Bell Ranch. And he told me at the time it was the biggest ranch in the United States.
And did he talk about his experiences?
A very little bit. He was rather, shall we say, terse, but he did have rules when we were riding our horses and taking care of them. We were never, ever, ever allowed to let go of a horse if we fell off, because he remembered from his ranching days that if you let go of the horse, you were dead. No one would find you. You would have no way of getting back.
Because that horse might make a run for it, and now you are all on your all alone out in the open.
Exactly.
Well, that's interesting.
Never let him go.
So better to hang on even if you're being dragged, because it meant you're still with your horse?
Anything. Didn't matter if you had a broken leg, a broken arm, you hung on because that was your life.
Wow.
Yeah, what gives you a sense of just how vast the open plains are, and the spaces are just extraordinary. It's still wonderful out there. I would urge the listeners to get in their car and drive out there this summer and visit the American West. It's really still extraordinary.
Anne, thank you for that. And let's now go to Candy, who's calling from Clarksville, Tennessee. Candy, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Sasha. I am, like I told your girl, I am a direct descendant of Miller Meat, which means that my family has been in the cattle industry since the turn of the last century. They homesteaded Oklahoma, and all the cattle from Texas would come to Miller Meat to be slaughtered. And my family continued this well up into the 90s. And my granddad paid me $2 a day. No, I'm serious. $2 a day to punch cattle, to do everything a cattle rancher did, because he was not graced with grandsons or sons. He was graced with daughters and granddaughters.
And when you say punch cattle, what does that mean in cattle terminology?
It means branding them.
And you were doing that at age 12? You were doing work like that?
Yes, I was. And I come from on my dad's side, I've got rodeo. So I never knew that, you know, hard work was not important. I was taught that by generations of men.
So that was the lesson. Was that a big lesson you learned from that experience, the value of hard work?
Yes. Always hard work. Always hard work. And I've heard, you know, stories about running ranges, doing fences. I've heard it all. I've even stretched fences myself. So I know what these poor men went through, but not to the extent they went through it.
Candy, thank you for that. Let's also hear from John, who's calling from Newport, Vermont. John, welcome to On Point.
Yes. I'm glad to hear this program. It's very interesting. My grandfather was a cowboy, and he wore Montana chaps. That was the fur out to keep warm. And he knew all about the cattle business, but he only made $1 a day when he was a cowboy. And he didn't make much money, and it was terribly hard work, and he lived out in the open, and they had very little to eat at chow time. And it was just a very stressful existence. But they did it because that was the only work that was available to them. And he had a single-action Colt revolver, 44-40, and he had a Winchester 73 in the same caliber. And they would shoot wolves and coyotes and things like that when they were moving cattle, because they seemed to follow along looking for strays or cattle that were sick or so. It was an interesting thing. My grandfather, I loved him so much, and he knew so much about the West.
John, do you think your grandfather got any pleasure out of the job?
He did get some pleasure, yes. He told me that it was free. That's what made him love it so much. You were free.
He wasn't trapped behind a desk, as many of us are.
Yeah, and he was out in the open air. He loved it.
John, thank you for that. Chris Knowlton, as you hear these stories, is this very familiar to you? I mean, you, for example, got into this wonderful archive in Wyoming that included firsthand accounts of ranchers. Is this the kind of thing you would find in that archive?
Yes, absolutely. And by the way, I had a little bit of this experience myself. I worked on a cattle ranch when I was 16 and spent the summer bucking bales and herding cattle. I even had a chance to ride a bronco in a rodeo. I think that's sort of where this book probably really comes from. But, it's all very familiar.
Chris, there's a whole chapter in your book dedicated to barbed wire. Why did that deserve a chapter?
Well, barbed wire may seem like a rather mundane piece of technology, but it really revolutionized the West. And it did so by, of course, allowing these enormous open-range parcels of land to be reduced into smaller pieces. And once the cattle could be confined, particularly the bulls, which were the most expensive article on the ranch, and they could be controlled a little better, there was less need for the cowboy. So it immediately started to endanger the cowboy's prospects. And that's one of the things that ultimately led to the range wars. But barbed wire also, of course, has a later impact. We see it used in, trench warfare and incarceration. And so it's a rather significant piece of technology. And it actually changed the appearance of the American landscape, so that today when you fly over the country and you see that kind of patchwork quilt, a lot of that is a function of barbed wire.
We have another caller. This is Bob calling from Portland, Maine. Bob, welcome to On Point.
Hi there, Sasha and guest. Thank you for having me. somebody has to mention that, first of all, these are cows. They're not native to North America. Bison were that they displaced. And cattle ranching was a terribly ecologically destructive activity. Bringing cattle into the West, which is fairly arid and actually pretty lousy for raising animals other than native animals that were designed to live there, caused the destruction of Native American people out West. It continues to this day to decimate native wildlife, wolves, cougars, you name it, prairie dogs. Basically, the cattle industry has gone to war with the ecology of the West, and it's a terrible, terrible situation. And I know the guest who wrote a wonderful book, it sounds like, is not at all trying to glamorize it, but it actually is quite a destructive industry and continues to this day.
Well, Bob, thank you very much for raising that, because that is a key point, and it is one that Chris Knowlton raises in his book. So that's a wonderful transition for you, Chris, to talk to us about some of the disastrous consequences of overgrazing, overinvesting.
Yeah, the caller makes some very good points, and I go into this in some detail, because this book is not just a history of the cowboy. It's really natural history married to Western history. So I take very seriously the plight of the bison and the gray wolf. I talk about the ecological effects, to say nothing of the catastrophe for the Native American Indians that the extinction of the bison led to.
Because it destroyed their food population.
It destroyed their food, and they used the bison for housing, the skins for housing and for, clothing. And it was really the the whole culture of the Plains Indian tribes was based around the bison.
You have a striking picture in your book of this mountain of bison skulls. It just gives a sense of the scale of the destruction, the death of these animals.
Yeah, it was slaughter on a massive scale, and of course the cattle that were introduced really do behave differently than the bison do, and there was an environmental disaster awaiting, and I don't gloss that over. It's an important part of the story. This is really a cautionary tale about, you know, avoiding kind of economic and environmental realities. And I think that's one of the reasons it should have some resonance for readers today.
The positive side of this, which you point out, is that essentially, to some degree, the conservation movement grew out of this. There was a recognition of the mistakes, of the devastation, and people like Teddy Roosevelt wanted to correct that. And so tell us about the conservation movement that grew out of this.
Yeah. Well, of course, the bison was perhaps the first thing, and there were some people like William Hornaday, who was curator of the American Museum of Natural History in New York, who called attention to the extinction of the bison and was able to keep it from going extinct, although it'll never be the keystone species it was at one point. But, you know, there are bison around. Teddy Roosevelt's experiences were even more seminal because he got out there to the American West. He was following a couple of his Harvard buddies out there. He got into the business. He was an avid hunter, and his free time was spent, you know, hunting for what he discovered was an increasingly diminishing amount of wildlife. Not just bison, but the elk and the deer were also disappearing. And he wrote about his experiences as a rancher, and that first book was critiqued by the author of a natural history magazine in New York, and the two of them got together. Roosevelt was rather indignant about this negative review, and they hit it off. The editor's name was George Bird Grinnell. He would found the Audubon Society a couple years later, but the two of them founded the Boone and Crockett Club, which was really the first conservation organization in the United States. And Teddy Roosevelt took this idea and really ran with it. And when he got into the presidency, he was responsible for creating, you know, five national parks and any number of national monuments, forest reserves. He really was our greatest conservation president. So really out of this era and out of the cattle business, grew the American conservation movement, which, I don't think you can underestimate the importance of that.
Chris Knowlton, let's go to another caller. This is Joe calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Joe, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Sasha. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Talking about a few things, I grew up on the East Coast in Maryland and lived for 2 years in Wyoming on an operational cattle ranch. And a few things, I guess you're talking about conservation now, they see there's a lot of efforts to conserve. And you were talking about overgrazing and mitigate the impacts of overgrazing, which are all well and good, except a lot of the times when put into place by the Bureau of Land Management and stuff, it becomes a battle between the ranchers and what they see as overreach from the government. And it's a shame that they don't work more as partners with the ranchers and listen, I think, more to what they have to say. A lot of the workers, a lot of the people who work at the BLM have their own agenda and see it as the only way forward and right.
Joe, thank you for that. Chris Knowlton, how much did you get into modern day and the research you did?
I do talk about it. I do talk about exactly this. It's not exactly a war, but there's certainly a fair amount of enmity between the two sides. This all really goes back to the open range cattle era. And that was really when you had these first arguments over how the American land should be used. But I talk about the evolution of the thinking, and there's a lot of modern day stuff, not just rotational grazing, but holistic range management that's being applied today. And I talk a little bit about some of that too, so people can see how the industry has evolved. And some of the stuff is much more ecologically friendly than it used to be.
Does it feel unresolved to you, the best way to do it?
Well, I think the complaints on both sides are probably never going to go away. You have just some very deep-seated beliefs about whose land it is and who gets to use it and how. And it's hard to see that changing much.
You also mentioned this at the beginning of the hour, Chris Knowlton, but you came to believe that the cattle sort of boom of this era was the dot-com bubble of its day, that it was a classic boom-bust cycle where people got drawn into investment mania and it inevitably crashed. Briefly, tell us the lesson learned there.
Well, it is indeed a investment frenzy by the end, people just throwing money at it. And so it becomes a kind of cautionary tale that I think people can learn from today. Something looks a little too good to be true and the investment returns are, 25% a year and it's easy and, you can get into cattle ranching and make your fortune in no time. Well, it was all too good to be true. I talk in Cattle Kingdom about, how important it is to have a competitive advantage, even in a business like this. But turns out to be a commodity boom that has a commodity bust at the end.
Well, it's a wonderful book that gives such incredible visuals. You feel it, you see it, what those cowboys went through. Chris Knowlton is the author of Cattle Kingdom, The Hidden History of the Cowboy West. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast on our website, onpointradio.org. Here's the Americana trio Nickel Creek with Ride Cowboy Ride, the first track off their 1993 debut album, Little Cowpoke. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
You uppers get ready to be at your best. Let's saddle them ponies and tighten the cinch.
Yahoo!
Pull on your gloves and take your hat off the fence. We'll get the cattle to market.
Yeah!
And after they're sold, you can all let your hair down. Get lazy or bold. Ride into town to find a lady or two. She'll take you by the arms and shake the dust off your boots. Come on and ride, cowboy.
Trail.